The idea at its core is there's many great solutions. There's many great technologies out there. But to really make an impact, you need to make sure that you are working on something that is truly an unmet need.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Kate Rosenbluth, founder and chief scientific officer at Kala Health. Kala Health is a neuromodulation company delivering non-invasive treatments for movement disorders. Kala Health's first product on the market is the Kala Trio, a wrist-worn therapy for hand tremors. Kate comes from a family of inventors, and she earned her PhD in bioengineering at UC Berkeley and UC San Francisco, completed a postdoctoral fellowship in neurosurgery, and has developed neurotherapies with companies such as Brain Lab, Autonomic Technologies, and Genentech. She shares her insight on pursuing meaningful innovation despite the volatile landscape of startups in Silicon Valley. Here's our conversation.
So thanks, Kate, for joining me this afternoon. It feels like very cloudy, so for a second I thought it was in the morning. But I thought it would be great for our listeners to hear about, you have a really interesting background. You have a PhD from UCSF, scientific background in academia, but then you make the leap to be on the entrepreneurship. And you know, so that's a big question, that if you can give us some of the flavor.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for the invitation to join you today. Really looking forward to the discussion. So walking through some of my background, I'll go right back to the very beginning. So I was born in Toronto, Canada. I came out to California for undergrad at Stanford and have stayed here ever since. When I think about that sort of scientific journey and where it ended up leading me to founding and building Kala Health, that is a neuromodulation company delivering non-invasive therapies for diseases initially focused in the area of movement disorders, which was what I was studying when I was at UCSF as well. When I think about sort of where that journey started, I would really take it back to, I come from a family of inventors that are specifically focused on how to make people's lives better. So I'd say a very sort of patient-focused, happiness, health, wellness. My great-grandpa worked in the coal mines on some of the early sort of what became things like stoplights for making sure that the different mine carts weren't, you know, bumping into each other or sadly sometimes bumping into people. My grandpa then was a modern architect. I actually went through all of college thinking that I wanted to be an architect before getting into the field of bioengineering. I saw that just as a beautiful intersection of sort of art, science, technology, and society. Then it was really when I was out at Stanford and I had some diversity funding for doing research, I met a terrific, you know, biomechanics researcher named Scott Delp, who fast forward was my co-founder for Kala Health. Scott was doing work on dinosaurs and ostriches, which was my first scientific publications. So I...
Dinosaurs and ostriches?
Dinosaurs and ostriches.
Tell me more about that.
So he was building beautiful, basically systems for doing musculoskeletal modeling that actually form the basis of a lot of the industry that really became sort of motion pictures and Avatar, you know, how you discretize and quantify human movement in a way that you could use it to do everything from, you know, predicting for children with cerebral palsy when you're doing tendon reinsertion surgeries, doing things like predicting before you do the surgery, where exactly you want to reattach the tendon to restore normal locomotion. At the time when I met him, he was working with a terrific researcher named John Hutchinson, who's now at the Royal Veterinary College over in England, who was doing work on really trying to model things like whether dinosaurs had to be semi-aqueous or whether they could have walked on land because their bone density is not big enough to support, is not dense enough to support their weight. Mm-hmm. So as a, you know, undergrad, I thought science is really fun. I can, you know, work on ostrich biomechanics and dinosaurs. And that's how I really ended up sort of in the field of bioengineering and really looking at health applications of these technologies. Around that time, I also got bitten by the entrepreneurship bug. So I'm trying to think, when I was wrapping up my undergrad, was around when FaceMash, which was Mark Zuckerberg's precursor to Facebook, that was when that was growing. You know, Google was growing through its explosive growth. I interned at a really interesting early stage neurotechnology startup called Epoch Innovations up in San Francisco. It was the COO was Keith Raboy, who was of the PayPal, what people affectionately refer to as the PayPal mafia, with Elon Musk and others. Epoch was in the process of rapid failure. The company went under in the 6 months that I was working with them. But that was really my first peek at neurotechnology. The company was using heart rate variability and biofeedback for treating dyslexia. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was hooked on how to actually use health and technology and engineering to improve patients' lives. And so I signed up to do a PhD. It was in a joint Berkeley-UCSF program, and that gets to the UCSF part of the story.
So tell us more about your experience at Epoch, because I think learning for something that is not working is also a big lesson learned that is kind of nice to see before you start your company.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I actually
went wrong.
I went to Epoch knowing that the company was heading in a negative direction. And I actually went to try and understand that, you know, what does failure look like? Mm-hmm. And where sort of and how does the organization.
That's very counterintuitive. Most people don't want to join a company that they know is going downhill.
You know, it's funny. I love the quote from Thomas Edison, who said, you know, if I've succeeded, it's because I've failed 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. And I am a deep believer in that fail fast, pick up and move on mentality. So I actually thought understanding why a company like that was struggling. I would say they clearly had a product that could help children with dyslexia. They were going through some really interesting strategy dilemmas around the typical for the healthcare field. You know, how do you get the product paid for? How do you get patients access to the therapy? Mm-hmm. The company's product today, I think, would have fallen into the category of digital therapeutics, of prescribed, mm-hmm. you know, physician-prescribed therapies delivered to the patient at home. Mm-hmm. The field of digital therapeutics, the idea of actually positioning an app as a drug, didn't exist yet. The company was, you know, far ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that it was a really great place to learn everything from intellectual property licensing. The company's IP actually came out of a terrific Israeli scientific group. And so it was really a place to essentially do case study work on, on what happens when the company referred to their team meetings as playing in the sandbox, and what happens mm-hmm. when that playing in the sandbox is going well, and what happens, you know, when it goes in a more negative direction. And so really, you know, after that summer, I was hooked on neuroscience. I was hooked on, you know, finding better ways to treat the brain. And so when I went into my PhD, I focused on medical imaging in Dr. Sarah Nelson's lab right. At UCSF.
Yeah.
And have stayed in that field ever since.
Yeah. So I'm sorry to go back again. Like, can you share with us, like, what is your 3 lesson learned from that, your Epoch experience, that you remember it now when, you know, as you go through your starting, your founding of a company and operating the company?
You know, I think, let's see, three lessons learned. So I think one would be that great science and technology can out-survive the ups and downs of company funding and company reinvention. I often, when I'm, you know, speaking to people outside, sort of, I'd say outside of the really rich entrepreneurial ecosystem in Silicon Valley, and they'll say, you know, isn't it a big risk to be working in early stage startups? I work in early stage startups. My husband works in early stage startups. And we often are stepping people back to say, no, working in the entrepreneurial sector itself is not risky, as long as you have the mindset that any single company may come and go, but the field, a rising ship floats all boats. So working in the right field, even if a single company doesn't survive, for example, that technology, those people, those skill sets, I have since worked with multiple people from that company who I have hired in on my own teams, or who I've continued to pursue that research. So I think that that's a really kind of key lesson is to sometimes separate the evolution of a field or the evolution of sort of a scientific basis from the, you know, survival of a single company. I think the next thing is that, I mean, a lot of people may allude to this in startups, but it's really people, people, people. And, you know, great, great, great people, you know, make a team fly. And as I say, I mean, there's multiple great people who I work with there who have actually continued to be collaborators and colleagues long after that company. And yeah, the third piece would probably be just that embracing failure and realizing that sometimes just because an individual company in that case is too early for its time, it's still worth continuing pursuing, in that case, this area of biofeedback, sensors in the field, the technology intersection mm-hmm. with medical practices. And sometimes you actually need to go through understanding the graveyard of companies that failed to really understand how to build a company that succeeds.
Right. Yeah. I think timing is also everything. Sometimes, you know, it's too early. The rest of the world has not kept up. And then the infrastructure is not right there for it to take off.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
Fast forward, you are Yessa, and taking the PhD about you have an aspiration to be staying in academia, because you kind of sort of did.
Yeah, certainly. I'd say at that time, I saw myself as staying on the academic path. My father's a professor at the University of Toronto, and he was the first in our family to be deeper in the neuroscience field. He was actually a neuroscientist turned sociologist who really studied the intersection of social theory and neuroscience. So things like explaining group behavior through underlying neuroscience principles. I grew up in a family that always had postdocs out on our front porch, you know, debating these topics. And I just thought that I lived on the right by the university campus and just thought that that was a career path that I could see for myself. So I did a PhD in bioengineering. I then actually did a postdoc working in neurosurgery, mostly in fields like gene therapy. And Parkinson's, which ended up laying a lot of the groundwork for the future work that we would do at Calla in neurostimulation and movement disorders. So at the time when I went into my PhD, I certainly thought that I was on more of an academic trajectory. Maybe I shouldn't downplay too much the challenge of being in a failing startup. I actually had a big dilemma about whether to go in more of a, I'd say, public health direction or more in the entrepreneurial direction. I spent some time over you mentioned that there's some listeners to the program who are in Africa. I actually spent some time living over in Swaziland, down in Southern Africa, in a kingdom nestled between South Africa and Mozambique, working with Tom Khalil, who was at Berkeley at the time. He was then he was in the Obama administration in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, and Teyajin Rudasingwa, who was the General Secretary for the Rwandan Patriotic Front, but has been in the U.S. in exile since around 2003, 2004. They were running a program basically in global health discovery. That was an area I was extremely passionate about as well, but spent some months doing that work and realized that, you know, public health, while I'm very passionate about it, I do not have the patience, for example, for the weeks that I spent sitting in the Ministry of Health waiting to get all of the certification and sign off to conduct our research on AIDS prevention. Swaziland has the unfortunate position at the time of having the highest rate of HIV/AIDS in the world. And I think that just taking, again, those kind of experiences to actually dive into something you think you might want to do, to then pause and say, this is a wonderful direction for many people. I'm more of an entrepreneur innovator. I like to move very quickly on those. And so I actually ended up sort of redirecting my doctoral work into a much more traditional field, into high field medical imaging, and really digging in on the entrepreneurship side as well. So I interned at Genentech. Sue Desmond-Hellmond at the time was the chancellor of UCSF. I worked on neurodegenerative, both imaging as well as drug development with Genentech through my PhD. And that really put me in a nice position then at the end of that to sort of step back and make the decision about, you know, do I want to pursue a more traditional academic career or an industry career? Fortunately, at the time, through connecting with Andy Grove, with one of the Intel founders, team, CEO, through, you know, its really exponential growth, really being at the core of the growth of Silicon Valley, I ended up actually taking a postdoc that was in a neurosurgery lab that was largely funded by Andy, by his family foundation. He had Parkinson's and was very active funding research in Parkinson's. While at the same time, I worked heavily in industry. I actually lived over in Munich and worked at Brainlab, which was one of our academic partners, our industry partners working with the university. So what I think I would just sort of take away from that for people is, even when you're unclear where you belong in the more academic industry in that walk, is that there are places, I think UCSF is a really fantastic example of this, where people recognize the need to both do basic research and do that for the application to society. And so I've been able to kind of move back and forth between both working on the implementation and execution side and on the more basic science at the same time.
I think from your experience, it also tell me a little bit about your personality, that you're willing to move to chase something that's interesting.
Absolutely. You know, when I went, when after my PhD, when I went back to, I actually went back to Stanford where I'd done my undergraduate to do another fellowship in a terrific program there called the Biodesign Innovation Fellowship. And at that time, my husband and I had just found out I was pregnant with my first child. And we said, let's do this again. Let's just move again. Take the time to explore some other directions in our careers as well. In that case, it was quite heavily sort of on the more entrepreneurship innovation side. And I went back and did the, took months of literally doing observation in the hospital's system.
This is through the Biodesign program.
This is through Biodesign, and just got fascinated with solving some of these unmet needs around movement disorders. And, you know, yes, looking back on it, I feel like it's a very circuitous route.
Come back to full circle.
It came back full circle because it was actually the opportunity that ended up kind of, I'd say, pulling together the more engineering, mechanical, electrical engineering. I never thought I would end up, you know, founding and running a hardware company as we are now. Mm-hmm. So it actually pulled that work along with sort of more of the neuroscience signals and systems work, along with the more entrepreneurship ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly hindsight's 2020. Now it all makes sense that those pieces came to be Kala.
Yeah. So the program itself, tell us a bit more about the program. Do you find your teammate and co-founder from that program? What is the inflection point that make you to decide, like, okay, this is, I'm going to do it full time while I'm raising my baby. I should, by then you have the baby.
So the genesis of that sort of program and that next phase is in needs-based innovation. So the idea at its core is there's many great solutions. There's many great technologies out there. But to really make an impact, you need to make sure that you are working on something that is truly an unmet need. And I am a deep believer that the way to do that is through a very rigorous process of observation, defining need statements, ranking need statements against other need statements, carrying that through essentially a process where first you identify a need, you prioritize all your different needs. Our team of, we work together in a team of four people spanning essentially business, engineering, and medicine. And we came up with a list of about 800 different single observations. You know, it could be everything from, you know, a nurse who was struggling to find a blood vessel through to the need we ended up working on, which was a way to restore essential tremor patients, so people with hand tremors, a way to restore their ability to eat, drink, and write. We take those 800 needs, screen them down over time to getting over the course of about, that fellowship runs about 9 months. And by the end of the 9-month fellowship, we had sort of a handful of maybe 3 to 5 really unique unmet needs with very specific insights around where the opportunity was. The program has spun out numerous startups, so I'd say that the goal of the program is primarily a teaching program, as opposed to, you know, being an incubator for startups. It's mostly focused on that understanding the needs generation. I actually then stayed on at the university a second year and ran and dove deeper into that lead area around movement disorders and then ended up spinning out the company with funding. Our first round was backed by both Lux Capital and Johnson & Johnson Development Corporation. JJDC was also involved in the biodesign program.
So it's
sometimes these things come full circle.
Yeah. And then, of course, Renee now is, you know, the CEO of the Kella Health, and she was one of your first supporter, I assume, with the JJDC. So you're saying that you after the biodesign, you stay in academia working on the technology for a year within the university environment. And then
I did, and then I founded the company. So during that time, I was doing a number of different, entrepreneurship education initiatives. So I had previously, going back actually to working with Andy Grove on Parkinson's, I'd also worked with him on launching the Masters of Translational Medicine program at Berkeley, which is a very different model. It's a more scaled model of teaching, you know, medical translation, entrepreneurship, innovation, et cetera. And now I'm also back teaching in biodesign again. So in addition to the hat that I wear at Kella as our, you know, founder and chief scientific officer, I also am teaching. At that time, I did take another year or so to really build, to convert the understanding of the need to something that was financeable. At the time, even to pause actually there, I did not believe that this needed to be done as a startup company. I had no intention of being a CEO. I truly was focused on how do we take some very novel insights around how to treat the nervous system differently and how do we get those to patients. I remember when Scott Delp, my co-founder, and I sort of stepped back to say, should we do this in the university via grant funding? Should we, you know, take this out to a larger medical device company like a Medtronic, an Abbott, or a Boston Scientific? Or should we pursue this as a startup? And we were just, I'd say, extremely fortunate that that we brought in such, we had just such wonderful investors who brought a term sheet forward on our first round that it kind of, it just...
Well, I'm like, well, you know, you can't say no to that.
Any of our worries about doing it as a venture-backed startup, what was very different was, you know, in our A round, we had J&J in the B round, we actually brought in two other big pharma companies. So we brought in Novartis, GlaxoSmithKline. We also brought in two tech companies as investors, both Google and Qualcomm. And I think that that makes for a really interesting alignment of, you know, people who are trying to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
By bringing in the larger strategics alongside the traditional venture investors. And that's certainly something that I, you know, encourage other companies to do as well, is to look to who really builds value in the boardroom, and how could we, in that case, you know, foster really terrific conversations about what is the future of medicine? What is the role of tech in medical? What are the business models of how do physicians prescribe drugs, and how are those accessed to patients versus, for example, the device sector? So Kella is a highly interdisciplinary company at the intersection of those fields of, you know, neuroscience, neuroscience, medical device, and tech. And that's just been really wonderful.
So maybe give us a brief description or overview. What is Kella Health?
Sure.
And what is technology and what is trying to achieve?
Yeah. So our first product on the market is called Kella Trio. And it is a wrist-worn therapy for hand tremors from a condition called essential tremor. Essential tremor is a very, it's a very common condition. About 8 million Americans have ET, and there's a, you know, similar population prevalence around the world. I'd say, as someone who had worked in Parkinson's disease during my neurosurgery postdoc, I was almost, I'd say, embarrassed to realize how large an unmet need essential tremor was when I actually took the time to step back, do primary observation, and realize, you know, every day I was seeing patients, for example, who were in seeing the neurosurgeons asking for deep brain stimulation, absolutely in tears, distraught, because, you know, for example, their hand shook so badly that they couldn't write, they couldn't sign a check. They couldn't, you know, hold a spoon, a soup spoon to their mouth. And yet, at you know, in the previous coding, in the ICD-9 coding, you know, essential tremor wasn't even a named condition. It was basically a benign, non-Parkinsonian, essentially means of unknown origin, tremor. And it just really struck me of saying these patients are incredibly impacted in their lives. And yet there really has been so little focus on, you know, addressing their needs. So when we went back to the drawing board, what we ended up realizing is that you could actually pull a lot of the literature from the field of deep brain stimulation, where surgeons surgically implant a wire with a stimulator into a location in the brain called the thalamus, into a nucleus called the ventral intermediate nucleus. And watching that in the neurosurgery suites, I mean, to me, it's one of the most inspiring therapies that exists, one of the most inspiring interventions. The moment that that you turn on the stimulator, literally, you know, someone's hand will just stop shaking. And I feel like there's very few things. I mean, I'm very biased towards electrical medicines, but I mean, pacemakers, how we understand how electricity interacts with the heart. I mean, this is just an incredible class of technologies. So what we really did then was to step back in the field of essential tremor and say, deep brain stimulation works incredibly well. And most people with essential tremor, we put out a survey, and what we found was that most patients were not willing to consider brain surgery. And so we said, there's got to be a different way to do this. So what we did was we focused on the site of deep brain stimulation, tracing that out in the peripheral nervous system. You can imagine it as reimagining the nerves themselves as wires. And we realized that we could actually tap into the same site as DBS, but we could do it from the wrist. So we started experimenting with doing non-invasive transcutaneous stimulation. I thought actually that this would likely be an implant company. I'd also been working with a company called Autonomic Technologies that treats cluster headache and migraine, a headache company. So I was initially envisioning this likely being an implant company. What we quickly discovered was that we could actually control the tremor by measuring things like timing parameters by using motion sensors, just like are on a Fitbit or an Apple Watch. We could use those motion sensors to measure the characteristics of the patient's tremor. It would set the stimulation waveforms to be able to actually relieve the tremor from something that had the form factor of a wristwatch. So with the emergence of smartwatches, et cetera, we realized that we could really kind of bring together, I'd say, more of that field of wearables into the medical field. We then had to recreate the business model, because now we have a prescription wearable and we've never had the compliance issues of wearables getting thrown in the drawer because patients are aware of the acute benefit that they get from therapy. So going back to needs-driven innovation, at that point, knowing that we had something really special in the therapy itself, we had to actually go back to the drawing board to solve the need of how do you even get this therapy to patients? And we ended up creating a fully, basically digital virtual model. So we're a fully licensed distributor. We do everything from we receive the prescription directly from the physician. We then drop ship product to patients' doorsteps. We guide them through the calibration and setup of their individualized therapy and support them, you know, through that journey. So fast forward, none of us knew that the pandemic was coming. We're very fortunate that we really couldn't have built a more sort of COVID-ready business than having a fully digital model to actually support patients on therapy in the home.
Yeah, so that's really an interest in this. The pandemic threw a lot of people off. It's but we all learned that, you know, life goes on.
It does, absolutely.
And
people living with chronic disorders, you know, their disorders don't go away.
So I mean, what the aha moment, like from the implantable and then just to make it as a wearable, this is something that you guys think about before you got your first round of funding? Was it after the first round of funding? And
yeah, it's a great question. So if I look at the company has raised about $83 million to date in three rounds of funding. And when I look at our three rounds of funding, our Series A, Series B, and Series C, I would really characterize it as on the first round, we were fundraising primarily on the need. So what we had identified was a very large unmet need, an essential tremor. And I'd say we had a direction that we believed that we could help these patients. We did have some early clinical data, but we hadn't even invented a solution yet. We hadn't yet built devices. It was purely, I'd say, really insight around some of the basic sort of mechanisms and underlying neuroscience. So we raised the first round, which was around a $3 million round, started the company, spun the company out of the university, started the company. Then we started really saying, well, what is the device embodiment? How do we actually implement this? So we built our first devices in the Series A. We raised then the Series B. I think of it in the concept of need-driven innovation as being that was a round that was more about the concept. So in that round, we delivered the device. We got the device through regulatory clearance through the Food and Drug Administration's de novo pathway. So essentially a novel therapy with no predicate, no existing comparable device, but in a sort of more moderate low risk profile than, for example, surgical devices. So we received our de novo clearance on that round. We then raised our Series C, which was around $50 million. And that was to commercialize. So we've now been on the market about 15 months. We're really excited for some of the growth areas in the company. We've shared, we're thrilled to receive a breakthrough designation in Parkinson's from the Food and Drug Administration. We've also, you know, expanded our platform into other fields as well. So that was really more of a commercial stage round.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, because I think after you've raised that Series C round, you step aside as the CEO of the company and stay as the CSO. And Renee Ryan, you brought Renee Ryan to lead the company, and she was part of Kala from the beginning. And what make you that, you know, because I think oftentimes when you have the founding, you know, the founders, some founder decided they want to be the CEO all through the growth stage, and some being forced by investors to step aside, and some like you who wants like, you know, this is where I want to be. And what are the decision process in your head? And what do you recommend for other founders who are in your same boat?
You know, I think it's so sort of easy to get caught up in that. It's very easy to get caught in that identity and the challenges of changing roles. Fortunately, as I mentioned earlier, I never planned to be a CEO. I planned to help patients. And I am in a beautiful position now where in staying on at a company that I founded, but I lead our sort of science, new product work, regulatory, intellectual property, all of the areas of the company that I'm incredibly passionate about. I was thrilled to bring Renee on board. She joined literally a week before we commercialized, a week before we shipped our first product. So I have stayed on at the company as a member of our board of directors. I am on, I'd say, more of a learning journey on the commercial side of the company, on the commercial and growth phase of the company, while being able to continue doing, you know, the work that I'm incredibly passionate about. So I think that sometimes it just takes a sort of mature separation of ego from purpose. And I have so many days where I'm constantly saying to Renee, you know, how thankful I am for all the great work that she's doing and what she's carrying in the company, because it allows me to do what I love doing, which is truly, you know, technology, innovation, research. And it couldn't have worked out better to find a partner to come into that role who is the same person, as you mentioned, who actually led our Series A. So it just felt meant to be in coming full circle.
It's nice in a way because she has gone through the whole journey and she was on your board the whole time. So it's not like, you know, she did not know much about the company. So it's just kind of a good transition for her.
Exactly. I mean, in the early years, before we had, for example, commercial leadership, our commercial leader of the company was Renee, obviously in her board role. We spent many late evenings early in the journey of the company with, you know, a whiteboard, developing the commercial strategy of the company, that now is the commercial strategy that she is implementing.
Yeah. So I know we are running out of time here. I feel like there's so much question that I can ask you. I thought that would be good. Like, you know, I did ask you the three lessons learned from your experience working for EPUC, but like, what is your three lessons learned from founding Kala?
So my three lessons learned, I'd say number one would be always see the patient as your North Star. It's very, healthcare is a really complicated ecosystem. I'd say it's one of the most challenging areas to innovate because fundamentally the person who uses your therapy, the person who recommends your therapy or prescribes your therapy and the person who pays for your therapy are different stakeholders. And that leads to very, you know, I'd say complex dynamics on things like the intersection of the, you know, reimbursement, regulatory, product development, sales, marketing, et cetera, worlds. I think one of the things that we've done really beautifully is that from day one, we have said the patient is the North Star. We will always do what is, you know, first and foremost in the best interest of the patient. And that has led to just, I'd say, very consistent decision-making throughout the history of the company. Also goes without saying, when you're truly focused on serving the patient, you also return value to the investors. And, you know, to the employees as owners of the company. So I think that I remember someone telling me that early on, and I'm so glad we embraced that from the start. You know, likewise, I think having a very clear focus on mission and vision from early on. So, you know, we have not changed our mission statement since the first genesis of the company. And I think that it's just so easy to overlook when you're sort of in the day-to-day challenges of building early stage companies to always take the time to sort of step back and reflect on things like, what is your core values? What is your core mission? That leads to a really strong team culture and everything that you need to sort of carry you through the hard times. The third one I would think about, I like to call it internally, follow your nose. And it literally means the nose, because you hear no a lot as an innovator. And when you can separate that answer of no, or of you're doing something wrong, you should do something differently, and instead you can learn to say essentially thank you for criticizing what I'm spending my entire day working on, but why are you saying no to this? So I think a very good example would be when we turn that corner to being a distributor as well as a manufacturer. I had many conversations with people where I basically said, if we want to give the user, the patient, right? Patient is our North Star, a beautiful experience in how they actually receive, a delightful experience in how they receive product. Essentially, why can't we just be our own distributor? And I heard from many people, you know, here, no, you can't do that. More because that's not how it's done. And when you really take the time to listen to all of those no's, right? Or from going back to the field of deep brain stimulation, you have to implant the electrodes in the brain. But when you start asking people why, and then you help them get along with the journey for you of realizing eventually when you innovate your way through all of the answers of no, when you start hearing from people kind of a, I can't believe I didn't think of that. When we started hearing that from the functional neurosurgeons, or likewise, when we built that sort of digital integrated business model, when we start hearing from those same people, you know, I can't believe I didn't think of that, then those people are along for the journey. So I think one of the things we've really wonderfully done is, you know, over the years, for example, the people who we have brought on to our scientific and clinical advisory boards have often been the biggest skeptics of what we're doing, but they were extremely thoughtful, extremely experienced, and extremely engaged in saying no to a way that we then, you know, elevated ourselves to say, let's prove ourselves wrong. And, you know, now we're running studies, for example, with leading academic medical centers with the same people who were likewise very supportive and very skeptical at the same time.
Yeah, that's, you do need both, right? And then eventually it's so gratifying when they become your biggest advocate too.
Yeah. When
that was said. So, well, thank you so much, Kate. It's been great to see you again over Zoom after all this pandemic that where we cannot see people anymore. So thank you for your time. Thanks for your sharing your story.
Well, it's been really wonderful. Thanks for all the great discussion, and wonderful to reconnect as well.
thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Kelly Muscat, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.